present, although we don't expect any votes today. Today we have a presentation from Assistant Commissioner Matt Mossman. He is going to discuss for us the proposals, the tax provisions in the governor's proposed budget that was announced yesterday. Members, let me just suggest a plan for us for understanding these provisions and for hearings coming up. I've asked Mr. Mossman to come and basically walk us through the proposals, allowing questions on how these provisions would operate, and helping us to understand what's intended by the governor. He has to leave at 10 o'clock this morning to get to a hearing in the House, but he will be back tomorrow. And so we will have a second day of understanding the governor's proposals and maybe fleshing them out a little bit so folks in the general public can understand what's proposed by the governor. And then we will schedule at least one, if not 2 days, of public testimony so we can understand what the general public's viewpoint might be, and from folks here that represent groups and associations here at the Capitol. We'll want to hear what folks think about these proposals. And with that, Mr. Mossman, welcome to the committee. And so it begins, Mr. Mossman.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Ortman, Chair Ortman, and good morning, members. My name is Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Revenue, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. As we get started, as we get started, I have a number of staff here from the Department of Revenue, so when we get going through the proposals, I'll probably have some of them come up too, just to make sure that we have technical questions that we can help make sure members understand the proposals, answer as many questions as possible, obviously, as we're going through. To get started, I just wanted to kind of make a couple points that were direction and priorities, that we were given from the governor that really kind of frame up the priorities that he had in making the choices that he did in the overall budget and in the tax proposals. The first was really obviously needing to pull together a balanced budget and to have that budget make a good deal of progress on structural balance over time. In doing so, progressivity was a key. The progressivity of the overall state and local tax system was a key priority of his, and I think you'll see as we go through that pretty much all of the choices in the tax revenue area are driven by that interest in wanting to improve the progressivity of the system, including wanting to avoid or not have state changes that increase the pressure on local property tax burdens. Related to that also was a strong sense in wanting to have the state budget to have the choices that balance the state budget be things that were done at the state level rather than at the local level. Those are just some of the things as I get started walking through that were priorities that and directions that we were given in helping formulate proposals for the governor, and I think you'll see those as we go through the budget pages. Your staff gave me this handout as well from the presentation yesterday, so I don't know if you wanted me to start there just to kind of give the overall these charts put together by MMB. Obviously, starting with what I think if you all have it, it's slides 3 and 4 from a presentation yesterday that shows the change in revenues of the, I'll start on slide 3. The governor's proposed actions have some small changes that carry forward from fiscal 2011, changing the starting point, the beginning balance there, and then there's overall revenues increased by $4.1 billion, expenditures decreased by $1.9 billion, and then there's some reserve changes in the cash flow account, and that essentially is the kind of big picture makeup of the budget proposal. slide three, and I, of course, wasn't involved in many of these, so I don't have the familiarity in terms of being able to give you a lot of background on these individual line items, but moving on to slide four here of what was handed out shows you the overall picture in some of the high-level budget areas in more detail of where the $6.2 billion deficit, how that's resolved in the governor's budget proposal with the net expenditure reductions of $1.4 billion for the K-12 shift and $485 million in net reductions after some new expenditures as well. And then again, the increased resources of $4.1 billion, $2.4 of which is from temporary permanent tax increases, $918 million from a temporary surtax on incomes. We'll get into that in a bit. And then healthcare surcharges and some other transfer changes and the cash flow account.
Mr. Mossman, can you help me just to understand? I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying the governor is only cutting by $485 million, that we have a $6.2 billion deficit and we're going to cut less than 7% or less than half a billion dollars? The rest all comes from new revenue and shifts?
Madam Chair and members, again, I'm going to be able to speak to more as we move forward to more of the tax-related proposals in here. But, yes, I mean, obviously these are the choices that the governor has made overall. I know that he feels that the spending reductions in here are the spending levels, I should say, in the proposed two-year budget are what is needed for Minnesota moving forward. And I think all of it, again, just reflects his priorities in terms of the need to fund programs versus what the adequate resource level is.
Well, and further, the general fund spending would increase by 22%. I just want to understand what the facts are here, Mr. Mossman. Is that right?
Would be an MMB-generated number. My recollection, I don't know what the spending number is after this. I know that revenues, I believe that the number that was in the presentation yesterday was that spending grows by 7.5% if you flip over I think on the back of this there's a couple additional slides from the presentation yesterday that give kind of an apples-to-apples comparison if you were to take out some of the one-time federal stimulus dollars and K-12 payment shifts in terms of what was built into the forecast relative to last year and just look at spending levels net of those one-time funding items that were used last biennium, that spending would increase 7.5%. You see the summary there. And I think this kind of shows how you get from the 22%, Madam Chair, that you were referring to the 7.5%.
All right. Thank you.
With that, Madam Chair and members, I'm going to just follow, I think, was what I had discussed with your staff. Just follow in terms of order what you have in the budget book. The tax budget book that was put out yesterday. So I'm going to actually start on page 5 of that document. And then I think we'll just take the proposals in order. And as indicated, we'll just go through and describe the proposals. And as you have questions, take those as they come up. This page 5 here just summarizes the proposals, recommendations, I should say, from the governor's budget package of yesterday that would be before the tax committee. The total recommendations for revenue changes on this page down in the lower right-hand corner would be an increase in revenues of $3.3 billion, increase in tax revenues of $3.3 billion in the next biennium relative to forecast. If we work from the top of the sheet, just kind of summarizing from a spreadsheet perspective the recommendations, $1.9 billion of that would come from the new fourth tier income tax bracket, and $918 million would come from the proposed temporary surtax on incomes over $500,000. That leaves about 25% of the income tax recommendations would be temporary. And when you look at the income earners over $500,000, and we'll get to those numbers in a bit, about 40% of the tax change for those tax filers would be, about 40% would be one time, or I should say temporary, not one time.
Mr. Mossman, why do you call it a surtax and not just a fifth tier on the income tax?
Madam Chair and members, the surtax, and I think surtax has been used before, perhaps surcharge has been used before in the past, just to kind of underscore the fact that the recommendation by the governor is that it be temporary and not be a fifth tier. I think when we see the draft bill, you'll see that it is not drafted as a fifth tier, and that is not the governor's intent or recommendation that it go into law as a fifth tier that remain permanent.
Do you anticipate, Mr. Mossman, that the legislative proposal will have a phase out or an end to the fifth tier or the surtax, as you call it?
Madam Chair, absolutely. The language, you'll see in the language that it will have, there will be an end date specified in the language for the additional surtax.
And then you've talked about legislative language. Do you have a bill that you're preparing, and do you have legislative authors for the proposals?
Madam Chair and members, we're not at that. I mean, we do have we have obviously been drafting the bill. We're not done yet. I think that, you know, given the process, it's probably closer to the end of next week. I don't know the final vetting of when that process will be completed, but obviously we have a sense of what's intended. And I should actually just clarify from the previous question, Madam Chair, I shouldn't leave it open-ended. It won't be that there is an end date. The governor recommends 3 years, and that will be the end date in the language that you would see. That is his recommendation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I think we'll have more information on the budget pages, so I'll just maybe jump to a more high level on this page 5 and then move on to the budget pages. The overall changes in the corporate franchise tax area would total $355 million for the biennium. There are about $31 million of recommendations in the sales tax area, and most of these things really are just things that were definitional changes that the governor felt were really tax fairness issues, in many cases taxing in all cases really looking at things that are already taxable under current law, but perhaps technology or the economy has changed, and so definitions and statute just haven't kept up. And then federal conformity, Madam Chair and members, would have a net loss of revenues of $18 million. And then the other tax area changes would come to $105 million net, and most of that is with the proposed statewide property tax on value over $1 million home.
Mr. Mossman, I know we're going to talk about all these things, but just so I understand, the federal tax conformity, does that include the Bush tax cuts, extending those into the next biennium for Minnesota residents?
Madam Chair and members, we list them on the budget page, the ones that are most of the ones, the kind of high-profile ones that are included and not included. It includes most federal conformity provisions. It does not include a couple of the kind of big-ticket items that were, frankly, more going to be more costly to fit into the budget, those being the phase down of the itemized deductions for the higher income earners and the married standard brackets.
What was that last part? The last?
I think he was referring to the marriage penalty.
Marriage penalty. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, I would move on then to page 6 is the first budget page. The governor does recommend, as I mentioned, in creating a new fourth tier bracket that would start at $150,000 of taxable income for married joint filers, $130,000 of taxable income for head of household, and the starting point for of taxable income for single filers would be $85,000. The department has, our research staff has taken a look at just what the gross income looks like for the average household in these ranges. To give you some context for that, the gross income for a typical married joint filing household with $150,000 of taxable income is about $200,000, and for singles, it's just under $100,000, $98,000. Again, in the middle of the page here, certainly the governor's priority and principles related to this proposal were the interest, was the tax incident study done by the Department of Revenue every 2 years, and his desire to want to make the tax system more progressive. And you see a summary here in the middle of the page of where the current tax system, overall state and local tax system, is at, with the lower 90% having an overall state and local tax effective tax rate of about 12.3%, and the effective tax rates tailing off at the higher income levels at about 8.8% for top filers, and wanting to, an interest of the governor's certainly was that his proposals recognize this differential and make some adjustment to it. You'll see on the back on page 2 of this summarizes the impacts of the fourth tier itself before we talk about the surtax. For filers, average filers under $75,000, there would be no change, obviously, until we get to the income range of $100,000 to $199,000, of which we would have about 51,000 tax returns that would have some change, and the average tax change for those, that income range would be $87. Moving up the income range from $200,000 to $500,000, there would be about 65,000 filers who would have an average tax change of about $2,700. And then the $500,000 range would have an average tax change of about $24,800. The increase as a percent of gross income is shown on the right-hand column there, and this is before federal tax deductibility. Madam Chair and members, I do want to point out that we just one adjustment in the budget page. Below that table, we have a sentence here where that refers to what the approximate change would be for the income earners over $500,000 being 1.7%. When we first modeled these, our initial models assumed that all of the state income tax would be fully deductible, and we now see that there's some filers who are in the federal AMT, so this number would go up a bit. It would obviously be somewhere between the 1.7 and the 2.5. The effective tax rate, we think now that it would maybe be more well, I won't give a number. It'll be somewhere between the 1.7 and the 2.5, but we'll get back to you with that number.
Mr. Mossman, you said that the, or at least the report here says that the fourth tier would not be indexed for inflation, so that it actually applies at a lower rate of income for Minnesotans than in the past, because all the other brackets are indexed for inflation, are they not?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. The other brackets are indexed for inflation. So the governor's recommendation here would be to have that bracket at the 500,000 level not be indexed. So it would remain static over time.
Does that also go down to the $75,000 income, the non-indexing, because that's our third tier? Are we going to index that one?
Madam Chair, the third tier would remain indexed. The governor is making no recommendations for changing the current law on indexing the existing tiers.
Okay. And then it looks like from the chart that Minnesotans with an income of $75,000 will have an increase. Am I reading that right? There will be some increase for some filers in that income range?
Madam Chair and members, no. Well, the range is $75,000 to $100,000, so no one at $75,000 would have a tax change. There will be a few people. The only people that would have a tax change would be people. They would all be at the
single
closer to the $99,000 level. They would be just under the $99,000 because, again, no one with an income. I mean, the starting point is $85,000 for singles of taxable income. This income range here is adjusted gross income, as I indicated, that for most single filers, that starts at about $98,000 to $100,000 for income, for gross income. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, I am going to have to comment on the fact that the governor has said that this would be a tax on the wealthy. And I wouldn't include folks at $85,000 or $150,000 joint income as wealthy. And I'm wondering, is there some kind of recommendation or study or census overview that suggests that suggested that number to the governor? Is there some basis for that conclusion, or is it just a subjective choice that the governor wants to impose a higher tax at $85,000?
Madam Chair and members, I think the governor's policy choices in this area were really, again, focused around the incident study is what he kept coming back to, and the top 10% pays less than the bottom 90%. That was really a key part of his recommendations, and if you look at the overall income tax changes that he's proposing, we estimate that it'll affect 5.5% of all filers, 5% of Minnesota resident filers. So across all of the income ranges, and of course, if you look at all filers, all 2.5 million filers, essentially, the 5% that will be affected, obviously, are all in the top range of income earners. That's the governor's recommendation.
Well, Mentor. Except that one moment. Except that the Taxpayers Association and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy say that Minnesota's is one of the least regressive income taxes in the nation. And so I'm hoping that we'll have an opportunity to maybe pursue that a little bit further. The tax incidence study says that the top percent or the top decile pay 56% of the income tax already. So I'm not following, and I hope to learn more about what is the basis for those conclusions that somehow we need to be more progressive when we are one of the most progressive in the nation. Senator Pogamiller.
Just a quick technical question on page 7. Is that income range is adjusted income, or is that gross income?
Madam Chair and Senator Pogamiller, that's gross.
So that's
income.
Tax.
It's gross income.
It's gross.
Yeah, it's adjusted gross income. So federal adjusted gross income. It's not taxable income. Madam Chair and members, the on moving on to page 8, the income tax, the surtax on incomes over $500,000, the governor recommends this surtax be put in place for 3 years. It would also not be indexed, and I would your indexing question, Madam Chair, again, at the $500,000 level, only applies to the 3 years. This is a temporary recommendation, and the revenue that would be generated from the proposal is $918 million in the 12-13 biennium. The number of taxpayers affected would be 20,000 returns in the adjusted gross income bracket of 500,000 and over, and it wouldn't change. It wouldn't change. These tax filers are already affected by the new fourth tier, so it continues that the income tax recommendations overall would affect only 5.5% of all tax filers and 5% of Minnesota resident filers. If you look at the bottom of that page, the table on the bottom of this page here takes into account the fourth tier and the income tax, the income surtax combined, and you see the effective tax change as a percent of adjusted gross income in that table being 0% for the lower income ranges and 1%, about 1%, just slightly over for the income range on average from 200,000 to 500,000, and an effective tax change of 4.15% for those over 500,000. This takes into account both of the income tax proposals together. Those percentages are before federal income tax deductibility. And again, just to kind of point out that in the sentence above this chart where we estimate that the effective tax rate after federal deductions for those over 500,000 will be 2.7%, with the AMT, as we kind of clean that up a little bit, it will be a little bit higher than that, but it'll be somewhere between the 2.7 and the 4.15 on average.
Mr. Mossman, I am going to have some questions about the viability of that fifth tier being temporary. Because if you impose higher individual income taxes, there's less investment in the economy and less growth, less high-skilled jobs are retained and brought into Minnesota. So I'm wondering, what is the viability of being able then, if spending is increasing, to somehow not need that income to balance 3 years out? I mean, I'm wondering, has the governor, the Department of Revenue, projected out 3 years to figure out, do we really expect that much growth in the economy given the counterproductive proposals here? How is that going to be viable in 3 years? And we're going to have some very serious questions about that here and in other committees in the Senate. And so I just want to let you know, we're very concerned about that. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a newbie on the committee, and Mr. Mossman, how many times in the past have we had a temporary surtax that has blinked off when we said it was going to blink off? Just out of curiosity.
80s.
Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I know there were surtaxes in the early 80s to balance the budget, and they did blink off. There was a year of a 7%. Actually, I'm not sure if they blinked off or if they were temporary and then they were ended, but they did end. There was a 7% surcharge, surtax on all filers for the first year, and then I believe there was 2 years of a 10% surcharge on all filers, and then they ended.
Thank you, Mr. Rosman.
Madam Chair and members, moving on, the next proposal is on page 10 of the budget book. Again, this really ties to the governor's recommendation and principles around tax fairness. The governor, and you know, he referred to this proposal on the campaign trail as the Snowbird proposal, is my understanding. But the governor recommends that there be Some changes put into law to for people who live in the state, are part-year residents, maintain an abode in the state. The governor recommends extending the income tax to those who are present here for more than 60 days but fewer than the current bright line test of 183 days for residency. They would need to maintain an abode in the state for 6 months, and if they meet those criteria, they would be subject to a pro rata tax on tax that is essentially not taxed in another state. So there would be a credit for any tax paid to other states, and there would be an exception for those people who are in the state to receive medical services.
Mr. Mossman, has the administration looked at the legality of that, and will they be prepared to talk to us about that?
Madam Chair and members, we have. We believe that it is legal. We know that there are some issues, and we're taking a look. We're continuing to look at the language just to make sure that if there's anything, whatever can be done to make more clear, perhaps ensuring that the language is tied to the time that you have an abode, so that you have housing here in Minnesota. But we do believe that it would that it is legal. Yes, absolutely.
I would appreciate any information you have that would support the legality of any change. The question of residency and domicile is well litigated, and it'll be interesting to see if that can be accomplished. And if it could, it's still a concern to me that we are basically asking people to make a choice, and their choice might not be favorable in terms of our economy. And I'm hoping that the administration will talk a little bit about that as well.
Madam Chair and members, the next proposal is on page 11. The governor recommends repealing section 290.0678 of statutes, which is the section 125 health insurance credit. The credit provides it provides a tax credit equal to 20% of the health insurance premiums for plans paid under Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code. What we have found is that this proposal is a pretty long form. If you were to look at the tax filing form for those who individuals who would be able to take advantage of this credit, it's been used by only 122 returns. In the last year, and what we've found is that the income ranges that people qualify for this health insurance credit are very narrow, and you don't necessarily even know that you would fall into the range until you kind of get done with the tax year. So in terms of the other recommendations that are going on in the overall budget around health care, the governor recommends that we would eliminate this health insurance credit. On page 12, the governor recommends a change in the current law treatment for non-resident entertainer tax. This is a recommendation that evolved out of discussions in the department just as a more straightforward way of administering this tax for both taxpayers and tax administrators. This would essentially, under current law, non-resident entertainers are subject to a Minnesota income tax, but there's a 2% withholding from the very beginning, from their first dollar earned. And under this proposal, it would repeal, and then there's a $120 credit. So there's a 2% withhold from their first dollar, and then there's a $120 credit that they can file and get that, some of those dollars back, or get credit for those dollars paid. And what this would do instead would to require the promoter to withhold 2% only on the amounts over $600, so that the promoter essentially, we wouldn't collect withholdings until the taxpayer reached a threshold where they were essentially going to be required to meet the threshold of filing Minnesota income taxes.
Mr. Mossman, before you go on to the corporate franchise tax, can you talk about the individual income tax? We've been talking about credits and changes to and adding a fourth and a fifth tier. A question for you. Do you have the information that shows how many Minnesota businesses are taxed as pass-throughs and would be affected by these changes?
Madam Chair and members, we have had the research staff do some work on that, and if I can get to the numbers here.
The most recent data I had, Mr. Mossman, was 2005 data that showed that 72% of Minnesota businesses are S corporations and partnerships that flow their income through the individual income tax. And so what I'd like to know is if the Department of Revenue has any new information about that, but that's a lot of businesses affected by changes to the fourth and fifth tier here.
Madam Chair and members, and we can get you some more formal information for the committee, but we have taken a look at that very question. In 2008, which is the base year that's used for modeling right now, there's about 360,000 returns there's about 360,000 returns overall that are sole proprietors, S-corp partnership, type of returns that you're talking about. 16%, this is 16% of all full year resident returns. So it's about 16% of returns, and 11.4% would have income that is subject to the 10.95% rate. The new fourth tier.
So 11.4% of businesses would be affected by the new tax tiers 4 and 5.
Madam Chair, 11.4% of returns would have pass-through income.
Okay.
That is subject to it.
We will want to quantify that a little if you can provide that information for us, because I think, generally speaking, we're concerned about investment opportunities and innovation and job creation, and very concerned that those very filers are not going to have the resources needed to make those choices, or may not want to, given the new fourth and fifth tiers. And Senator Rust.
Question on that same regard, is it the absolute dollar amount of the K that's on the K-1 or the Schedule C itself that exceeds that, or is it after it's brought in that and other income like investment income, et cetera, is what gets it over the threshold, or is that something you can't really tell? What are the elements of income for businesses that are report individual business income? Do you understand? Yeah, I'm sure you understand what I mean.
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, I'm not entirely sure that I do understand the question, but I think 11.4% of returns would have income that would be subject to the new rate. They would have other income as well.
Okay, so Madam Chair, what I'm asking is, the K-1s or the Schedule C in and of themselves would bump someone into that higher rate. So if they were bringing in $150,000 bottom line on their Schedule C, and then they had $200,000 in interest in dividends, or let's say they had $100,000 on their Schedule C and $200,000 on their interest and dividends, it wouldn't be the business income alone that would bump them into the the new rate? And can you differentiate that or not?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair.
That's a complicated question.
Senator Rust. I don't know the answer to the question as to whether or not we can differentiate.
Well, I think that, Madam Chair, that is the thing about, right. You know, is it the businesses that are being affected? Or let's say they have $90,000 and they wouldn't, from their business income, get into that, but then they have $100,000 in interest and dividends, and so now they're paying the higher rate on everything. I think it's an important point.
Senator Rust, I agree. It depends on the source of income, right? And how you get into that higher bracket is the question that you're asking. But my concern is maybe perhaps a little different. I'm worried that when businesses are taxed as individuals with that pass-through, they have less money to reinvest in their business or to expand their business or to create new jobs. And I'm hoping to get at that so we can quantify what this proposal may do, especially since there's a suggestion here or a promise that it's going to be, you know, ended in 3 years, and I just want to know how viable that is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
Just a follow-up to that, too. One of the things we never want the tax system to do is to determine the business form, the business structure that someone chooses. And if the individual tax system becomes far more of a burden than otherwise a corporate income tax system, we may have businesses saying, well, wait a minute, we're not going to be a partnership or whatever, we are going to try and find the tax structure or the business structure that reflects the lowest burden on us as an ongoing business. So I think that's an important question because we shouldn't be influenced to the extent possible. We shouldn't be influencing that decision.
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, and members, just, you know, call your attention to, these are all very good questions, and I'll get more detail for you. The House Research Department did, in cooperation with Department of Revenue staff and data a couple years ago, a study related to this topic in terms of small businesses and what is a small business. And the findings there are largely consistent with what we're still seeing in the data, which is that at that point, 84% of all sole proprietorships S corporations had reported income that was less than that was below the top bracket. So they were not top bracket filers. So 16% of all of those, all of the S corps, all of the proprietorships, all of the partnerships, only 16% had income that would they were top bracket filers. They weren't, to Senator Rust's question, that doesn't mean that income alone put them in the top bracket. It just meant that they were top bracket filers.
Right.
And what you have is a situation where, you know, you can choose to operate as a C corp or an S corp. So you have, even among that 16%, you have a small percentage of them that have a high percentage of all of the income. Of S corporations, partnerships, and sole proprietors. The other thing, you know, moving forward, just to think about, and this is, you know, an area that I've been learning some about in the past few days as well. But for some individuals, or for perhaps a number of the partnerships and the entities that are organized this way, in many ways, it's almost like it's salary income, because law firms, for example, would organize this way, and it's effectively, that's the income, but they're organized that way, so they're not necessarily a manufacturing plant or a business in that way. They might be accounting firms or law firms or other professional service firms that are organized, and so they would. They're being taxed in this way, and they're included in these numbers.
Right. And Mr. Mossman, what I'm concerned about is those very owners of those businesses who are taxed after they've paid all of their expenses. They take in what is essentially their own income. If they have enough, they're going to reinvest it. If they don't have enough, they're not going to reinvest it back in that business, and that's my concern. But I think whatever information you have about this that would help us learn more, we would like to do that.
Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Pogue-Miller.
Do they always reinvest it, or could they also spend it or put it in their bank?
Well,
I don't think I just think it's an overstatement to say that the only choice is reinvest or not. Absolutely, some do reinvest. Absolutely. But I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say the only choice is reinvestment.
Well, Senator Pogue-Miller, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's disposable income at that point. But I'd like to think we're encouraging the reinvestment in new jobs. I mean, if we're not measuring all these provisions by whether or not they are going to encourage economic growth, I think we've made a mistake. We want to encourage new jobs. We want to encourage investment. They may save it or use it on other things, maybe vacations. I just don't think there are a lot of business owners taking vacations these days. Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. There's a question in my mind that if you subject this group of businesses to a higher tax rate, they do have an opportunity to avoid the additional tax obligations simply by reinvesting more money in their business. Right, you know, at the business level. And this could end up actually as a vehicle where, in order to avoid the additional tax liability, it would make financial sense for them to invest more money in their business to avoid the additional, because they can avoid the additional tax liability for that. So essentially, the state ends up paying for some of the reinvestment in the business. And I do think a lot of those business people are likely going to take that path. Providing they have enough personal disposable income of their own, whether it's what they take out of the business or from some other avenue, it could actually stimulate more reinvestment in businesses to avoid the tax liability.
Senator Bach, I was reading a Joint Economic Committee report from the Congress of the United States that I found on the Internet, and it also talked about and referred to the President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. And what they found is that high marginal tax rates discourage work effort, saving, and investment and promote tax avoidance and tax evasion. To the opposite, a reduction in high marginal tax rates would boost long-term economic growth and reduce the attractiveness of tax shelters and other forms of tax avoidance. I think we're going in the wrong direction here if we're trying to encourage economic growth. I can't imagine folks here would dispute that. I mean, I think it's pretty well settled. It's not a partisan issue.
Well, Madam Chair, I invest money in my deferred comp to avoid the tax liability. Businesses have other options to avoid that tax liability, and it's reinvesting in their business, and they can avoid the taxes.
Well, but then, Senator Bach, that begs the question whether or not you can blink off this tax because there won't be enough economic growth to sustain our budget.
Senator Ortman, if it's in law that it goes away after 3 years, it's gone. And the only way it stays in place is if the legislature repasses it and the next governor signs it. It's gone. It doesn't renew itself. I mean, if it has a date when it expires, it's over. And the only way it'll stay in law is if the legislature actually passes the bill and the governor signs it.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I would say that I think there's very few taxes that we put on that that ever go away, because we're always looking to replace that revenue, and usually it's by continuing the tax. But I would say that there's another option that people have, and that's called leaving our state. And I think we need to make sure that the simpler and we have our taxes, and the more competitive we are, the more apt we're going to have people staying in here, creating businesses, starting businesses, and paying their taxes. You're absolutely right with the tax avoidance issues, that the higher we put these marginal rates, the more people are going to do to avoid. I do agree there will be a certain percentage that will reinvest in their business, and that would be smart. But I think there is a valid argument on the other side of that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
First of all, actually, we have had surcharges. I'm sure Governor Dayton is aware of that in the 80s under Governor Quay, and the surtax did go away when we were out of economic difficulty. I'm very interested, however, in the comment from the source that you read. I can understand making a point about workers and tax evasion, but I can tell you tax avoidance is an act of patriotism. Of course you shouldn't pay taxes that you should always avoid, try to avoid as paying as much taxes as you legally are able to do. People shouldn't rush to pay taxes, for heaven's sakes. Tax avoidance is a good thing as long as it's not illegal and becomes tax evasion. That's different. A patriot, in my opinion, I have clients that I advise that way. Of course we're going to try and avoid paying taxes that you don't owe and shouldn't pay.
Senator Rust, I think it's only following the law and reading and understanding the law and making good use of the
avoiding
law. I think we are in complete agreement.
Avoiding taxes that you don't pay is a good thing. I don't owe is a good thing, not a bad thing.
I think we're going to have more opportunity to talk about that when we talk about the foreign operating corporations and the royalty deductions. Any other comments or questions about the individual income tax at this point? Senator Pogemiller.
I wonder if I could have the page just pass this out. This was a chart that was in the tax incident study that was published by the Star and Tribune 4 or 5 years ago. This first I've seen of the governor's recommendation, but it just seems to me this is what the governor's talking about. And something we've been aware of in terms of the governor's argument of fair share. And this was data produced during the previous executive's administration. And this is simply a factual matter about who pays and who doesn't pay and what percent. It is absolutely true that the point you made, Madam Chair, that the group on the higher end, even though they pay a less percent of their income, they pay the bulk of taxes. That is absolutely true. But both things can be true at the same time. And that's the only point the governor's making, I believe.
Senator Pogemiller, I have also asked our page to hand out the pages from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association that we talked about before. It has the cover page, and it also has the pages that follow that talked about how and documents how Minnesota's individual income tax is the least regressive. It shows that married joint filers in Minnesota at the top income ranges pay on the U.S. average 111, 116%, up to 122% of the U.S. average in terms of individual income taxes. And you can see by the progression up the income range that it gets more and more progressive.
Absolutely.
It is a very progressive individual income tax by comparisons. Your point is well taken. I wouldn't dispute this chart at all.
Madam Chair, my only point is several of these things can be true at the same time. And what this chart shows is that if you take property taxes into account and sales taxes into account, total tax burden, this is the bottom line. And I think we all know that the only way to fix this chart is to make the income tax even more based on ability to pay. I mean, that's kind of the bottom line. That's the point I think Governor Dayton is making. Whether he's right or not is, you know, obviously people dispute that. But factually, based on data that's been developed by our Department of Revenue under previous administration, the just previous administration, these are the facts. And I think we should not dispute the facts. We can obviously dispute whether we think our conclusion to the facts is what we want or not. But you can have both the higher incomes paying the most in taxes, which is a fact, and you can also have the higher incomes paying less as a percent of their income, which is also a fact. And that's because if you shift to property taxes, which is the path we're on, I believe that has now taken over in our state as the highest taxation, property taxes. There was a decision made in the 70s to reverse that, and we've lived under that for years. But because we are now in a position where apparently as a policy we've decided to allow property taxes to become the biggest tax source, this is the result. And I note based on the governor's data here today, apparently the 11 projections are worse than this chart. So the trend line is going in the wrong direction.
Well, Senator Pogemiller, I don't mean to be argumentative with you, but I don't think the goal right now for the legislature is to fix a chart. I think the goal is to balance the budget and encourage growth in the economy. And I think it's a wrong focus to say we're going to try and make Minnesota's individual income tax even less regressive when it's actually very regressive. We have much bigger issues, and I'm truly surprised that what we're doing here is $456 million in cuts with all of these revenue increases to pay for them, because it doesn't encourage economic growth and sustainability in the economy.
Gotcha.
Senator Pogemiller.
A piece of this is the incidence of taxation. I mean, there are two pieces here, what we spend and what we raise. And I'm just stating what I think is obvious. Governor Dayton's position appears to be that one of the tools for balancing the budget in under what he considers a balanced approach is to ask those who are paying less a percent of their income than most Minnesotans to pay some more now. I just as a factual matter, that's what he's asking. Whether one agrees with that or not is why we're here. But that's what he's asking. I don't think you should trivialize a notion by a governor to suggest that our tax system should be based on one's ability to pay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howell first, and then Senator Chamberlain.
Well, I agree that we are going to drive behavior with this, and it's not just going to be a constant line. But the question is, at what point your top job creator, your top earners, are usually your job creators too, and at some point you're going to reach that point where you're going to change the behavior, and they have options. And if we take job creators and chase them out of our state, you know, we talk about having a business friendly climate. And we all know, you know, the way our tax structure is not business-friendly in Minnesota. And we talk about our high corporate tax rate, but we have a much lower effective rate. We need to get to that lower effective rate and reduce some of these exemptions and incentives that we use. So, on surface, we're just a much better climate to do business. But, I think we really need true reform in how we do this, and there's a lot of options out there, but there's a lot of fear, you know, going to like a fair tax system where we charge a rate and people at the lower scale can file for all the tax back. But, you know, the people at the low end of the scale actually benefit from our system, from tax credits and stuff, and they actually get more money back than what they pay in. And the people at the top end don't pay what somebody might say is their fair share because their income is way above, and it screws up all of it. You know, if you're looking at the top 0.1%, yeah, that's where that decimal point goes down, and it doesn't look like it's progressive. But we're going to change behavior with this, and I don't know if it's the right thing to do at this point where we're sitting in our economy, and that's the question: do we spiral further downward? Because of the changes that we're making in this tax. So I think that's just things we need to consider.
Senator Pogemiller, and then Senator Chamberlain.
Senator, I agree with much of what you said, and I think we need the effective rate on the corporate versus the sticker rate. Absolutely. I think there's a general agreement on that. But I think we need to look at how behavior is affected, and I think we have some historical data on that. And in my judgment, this issue that everybody's going to move out of state or they're going to move their business to South Dakota, I believe that's overstated. Sure. I believe there certainly are businesses and individuals that will make that decision if we do this. I absolutely think that is true. But you have to look, in my judgment, you have to look at the context overall and make a judgment whether that trade-off is worth it or not in terms of funding your educational system and so forth. So my only point would be is that I believe the argument that I believe the attack yesterday by some that this
this proposal by the governor was anti-job and would create no job creation in our state. I just believe that's overstated. And I think the evidence historically in Minnesota is that that is not the case. Not the case. But I do not dispute that individuals or individual businesses make decisions based on this. They absolutely do. But you have to look in the aggregate and see what the net effect is.
Senator Pogemiller, to that point, though, I thought we've been learning that it's also our ability to attract and retain high-skilled labor that's so important in our economy, and this is counterproductive for that. It's going to be very hard to recruit high-skilled engineers and scientists and folks to Minnesota if our income tax is so high and not competitive.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pogemiller.
I dispute that. I believe that's not the historical evidence. I think we were able to recruit during supposed high income tax regimes in Minnesota. Our economy performed much better. And so I think we need to be careful not to overstate some things that seem common sense, but if you look at the data, it's simply not true.
Senator Chamberlain, thank you for your patience.
Briefly, what we're not talking about appropriately so is living within our means. Simply jacking up and taking money from people who invest and create jobs and not addressing the other side is irresponsible, and it's not living within our means. We had to live within our means. We don't have the resources anymore. And just as a final note, Oregon did this, and they lost $50 million. Thank you, Mrs. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman, a question that was brought up in the exchange between Senators Pogemiller and Howe. Minnesotans have a very high income tax threshold at the lowest level. And my information is that in 2007, married couples with kids, with two kids, paid no state tax if they earned up to $34,500, and that was the fourth highest in the nation. Now, I understand that's part of how we get to be so progressive in Minnesota, but the governor talked about that provision or said that he was going to make some changes to that, and I'd like to know, is there a proposal to change the threshold? And I think that that's been indexed for inflation over the last several years, so it's probably actually higher than $34,500 at this point. So what is the governor's proposal on that?
Madam Chair, the governor has no recommendation in the budget recommendations to change the starting point for any of the other brackets, if I'm understanding your question correctly. I know that when you take into account working family credit subtractions, others, and so I might need to get more information on your question, but I know there's obviously a number of things that might otherwise affect taxpayers in that income range and result in them not paying any tax in terms of final tax liability. But if you're talking about the starting point for the tier, and I'm not aware of the reference actually that you're making also in terms of your indication that the governor was going to make some change there, but there's nothing in the recommendations that would change the starting points for any of the other tiers relative to current law.
Mr. Mossman, let me give you the reference. It was page 20 in the governor's 2012-2013 handouts, slides from yesterday. It looks like it's in the context of federal income tax conformity. I just want to understand if that's where that is, how it would affect our $34,500, if you know. And you're welcome to get back to us on that if you need to. But
Madam Chair and members, we don't. I can get back to you with more detail. We actually have one page. On income tax that we didn't get to yet, that's federal conformity. The governor does recommend conforming to the working family credit, the change in the working family credit limits that were passed last year by Congress and adjusting to those starting points. So that would have some effect of reducing the tax actually relative to current Minnesota law. I don't have all of those numbers for you today, but there would be some adjustments, some benefit to those income ranges resulting from that conformity provision.
Mr. Mossman, do you want to flip to that subject right now as a good one so we don't start in on the corporate franchise tax? I think if we just stay to the individual income taxes and conformities, that makes some sense for given our time.
Madam Chair and members, page. Get the right page, sorry. Page 22, then, of the budget book is the start of the federal conformity discussion. The governor recommends conforming the income tax to most federal changes made after March 18th of 2010. The recommendations would reduce general fund revenues by 23.2 million in the over the three-year period from fiscal 11 to fiscal 13. 18.3 million of that is in the current biennium. Certainly, making sure the tax system remains transparent and easy for taxpayers to use. In maintaining Minnesota's starting point of federal taxable income for most provisions is the governor's intent behind conforming to most of these recommendations. If we start at the bottom of page 22, because I know there's a lot of provisions out there and we don't summarize them all in the budget page, but to give you an overview of some that I think are of interest to the committee, the governor proposes that we would not conform to the federal law changes in terms of Section 179 expensing and the bonus depreciation, that we would continue the current law treatment of the 80% add-back and 20% subtraction. It does not include a recommendation to conform to the standard deduction for married filers or the itemized deductions and phase-out of personal expenses or the subpart F. If we flip the page to page 23, some other just items of note. It does include recommendations to conform to the deduction for tuition and expenses for K-12 educator classroom expenses up to $250, the working family credit, the dependent care credit, tax-free IRA distributions to charities, the deduction for mortgage insurance premiums, and the exclusion from the employer-provided insurance for children up to age 26.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mossman, obviously the federal conformity provisions are a menu of provisions that you can either choose or not choose. What was the rationale that led the governor to choose that salad of provisions and reject others? Was there some guiding principles that led to that, or was it? I can suggest some, but I'd rather hear what you have to say rather than telling you what I think.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, and members. I think around federal conformity, in the department's discussions with the governor, really the governor has been open to conformity generally, certainly because of its benefits just in terms of transparency and making the tax system simpler to use. Obviously, within the context of the overall budget challenges that we have, some of the provisions have significant implications for the state budget. Two of them in particular have a net change of about $270 million. $260 to $270 million of cost to conform to. So I think just in terms of the overall challenge, that was the biggest issue, I think, with the provisions that you're referring to.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
So is it like, okay, so we'll go with a figure of give me $24 million net of tax conforming changes, and we'll settle on that number and kind of back into it, which we do. How many of them can we do for this price? And $270 million is a lot to do on any single one, and you probably couldn't do any of the others. And I can understand. Sorry.
Excuse Send me. Arrest, is that your phone?
Yes. It'll stop in
Send
a second.
Arrest. I'll get you off the hot seat. I'll just tell you that one of my first hearings, my phone rang while I was presenting one of my very first bills in the Judiciary Committee. It was really late at night. But my phone didn't play for Elise. It played.
I know. Isn't that wonderful?
If I only had a brain from The Wizard of Oz. If I only had a brain. There it was, and it went off in the middle of the Judiciary Committee in my first bill, and I had to get up and walk back to my chair, get my phone, and walk all the way back. And yeah, I changed my phone ringer after that. Senator Rest.
Anyway, it'd be interesting to me if the governor is open to maybe having a different menu of, given a price tag, maybe a different menu of some of these conforming things, or maybe I'm making an incorrect assumption about having a budget for conformity and then working within that. I don't think that's unreasonable, but just curious.
Rossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I should probably clean up the characterization a little bit. The governor does have, it's my understanding, he certainly does have preferences within the menu that's reflected here. So I don't think he approached it as an allocation of this is,
how much we can
have
afford
for federal conformity. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mossman, you probably haven't had the benefit of all the same conversations we've had in the committee over the last few weeks about federal conformity. We're pretty committed to doing as much as we can to conform because it's anti-competitive not to, because our neighboring states are adopting some of these conformities, and that just makes Minnesota's climate less competitive when you look at the tax climate to our neighbors. And I want to say not only does that choice, the Section 179 and the itemized deductions and phase out of personal exemptions, those things, those are anti-business, but the standard deduction for married filers applies to all taxpayers. And that's essentially, if the governor is trying to say he doesn't want to impact the middle class and lower taxes, that does have an impact. And I'm wondering if that was part of the conversation.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right, and that was all part of the conversation. And, I think the challenge here, again, was just the not an interest in wanting to conform to the provision you're referring to, but the impact on the budget that it would have in doing so. Just to kind of underscore, obviously, all of the taxpayers affected by the provision you're referring to would continue to benefit from the federal law change, which is far and away the larger dollar benefit to the affected households than would be the state change, despite the $110 million cost to the state budget to conform.
Well, Mr. Rossman, when we looked at it, it was about $280 million, I think, in my memory, to do the Bush tax cuts, which include those provisions. They were pricey, to be sure, but following the governor's logic, you could just say let's tax at the top ranges even more to pay for those deductions across the board to hold the middle class harmless, at least according to the logic. So I'm wondering, why not?
Madam Chair, what I can tell you is that this collection of things is the trade-offs that the governor made in his recommendations. There may be other trade-offs or other recommendations that could be pursued or that perhaps will be pursued going forward, but this really is a reflection of the governor's trade-offs from all of the discussions, and observations that you're making on these provisions.
Other questions or comments about conformity provisions? Senator Howell?
Oh, no.
Senator Daley?
It's a question, but not about conformity.
Go ahead.
Is it
Senator
okay?
Daley?
Mr. Mossman, can we go back to the original sheet, page 3, 4, 5, and 6, just to make clear? As you look at page 4, the increased resources, 4.129. The percentage in your apples to apples, you're suggesting, or you said that it's 7.5% of an increase. Are you saying that we're going to get federal stimulus dollars this year as part of that assumption?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Daley, I think the way to interpret the slide the numbers on page 6 is actually the understanding that we're not going to get federal stimulus
exactly,
dollars.
Exactly. Yeah, so we have to make up for that with state dollars because it's not federal dollars, right?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Daley, that's correct.
Percentage increase, Madam Chair, is either 12.5% or 15%, depending on if you go with the 4129 or you take the difference if you take out the 2272 of federal stimulus dollars, depending on how you want to do this. But it's more like an apples to bananas comparison to me by suggesting that we're going to have federal stimulus dollars when you look at those assumptions. It's really 12.5% or 15% of an increase.
Of state revenue.
Senator Pogemiller.
Of state revenue, yes. Revenue. Yes, that's the point.
It's just misleading when you say it's 7.5% because the $4.129 billion.
This is expenditures.
Increased resources. We're raising taxes.
Let Senator Daley finish, and then you can respond.
No, he's got it. It's just the word is different.
Senator Daley.
We're raising taxes by that much, over $4 billion. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay.
Senator Pogemiller.
Madam Chair, Senator Daley, I think you've got it. The 7.5 refers to expenditure growth. What you need, the 34... I think the easiest way to explain this, and I was going to mention it when Senator Chamberlain made his point, we spent $34.5 billion last year, but a lot of that was not our money. And so we have to raise about $2 billion to stay where we are in terms of our level of spending. And so this is a case where both things are correct again. It is true that we will have to have more state money to get to that 7.5%, but it is also true that 7.5 is really the only spending increase under this proposal. But it will cost us more of our state money to only have a 7.5% spending increase.
Senator Pogemiller, you're a pretty passionate advocate for this proposal. Are you going
to
be chief author of this provision?
I'm an advocate for the facts, and I think the facts are pretty well laid out here.
Senator Pogemiller, will you be introducing a bill?
I haven't been asked.
Mr. Mossman, the fourth tier is permanent revenue raiser long term. How much more revenue does that provision raise? Is it $1.9 billion? Is that right?
Madam Chair,
fourth tier?
It's $1.9 billion for the biennium. If we go back to page 6, what happens on the income tax is you get a little bit more in the first year because of the way withholdings works. So it's $1.9 billion in the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium. Another way to think about it in terms of the on a ongoing basis, it's about $860 million a year in 2014, and then given that the forecast assumes the economy will be growing, it's $931 million in fiscal 2015.
And so, Mr. Mossman, that would pay for all the increases in spending, essentially, long-term?
Madam Chair, it's part of the governor's budget recommendation for structural balance. So it's part, as I know you're familiar, the structural deficit continues on into the fiscal 2014 period at about $5.1 billion of gap between spending and revenues, and this permanent fourth tier rate is part of the governor's recommendations to bring those two trajectories together and have a more balanced budget going forward and a more permanently balanced budget going forward.
Thank you. Other questions or comments about the individual income tax or the conformities on those provisions? With that, members, I did assure Mr. Mossman that he'd be done at 10 o'clock. He's graciously agreed to come back tomorrow. And so then we'll move on to the other types of taxes tomorrow for further discussion and exploration of what the governor's proposed. With that being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.